in Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 through 35 this morning. And I had a good week. Mary finally got back, so she got back last Sunday. So I survived the 4 days without her, and without Alyssa also, she's like our default nanny. And I had the boys. They're our sheepdogs. They just kind of run around barking at the little kids, making sure they don't die. And so Mary got back, and I just want to brag about her a little bit. She went to this conference for a homeschooling philosophy that she's a part of that was founded by a woman named Charlotte Mason. And it's a conference that's very popular. They open up registration, and within one day of having registration opened, it's full and nobody else is allowed to go. And she was one of the main speakers at the conference. And she wouldn't brag about herself, but Alyssa and things I saw on Facebook made it clear that she really did a great job. So I'm really proud of her. That was a neat opportunity for her. She wasn't the easiest to live with for the few weeks leading up to the conference as she was preparing to do that for the first time, but she did a tremendous job, and it was cool to see. And it's our anniversary today, and 17 years, and it was her birthday 2 days ago, so if you want to make her uncomfortable, get right up into her personal space and wish her a happy birthday and ask her awkward questions. She'll really appreciate that. Anyhow, so this morning we're looking at this passage, Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 through 35, and I think, again, the main idea here is to stay alert, this idea of the importance of Jesus' followers staying alert. And he says something in verse 25. He says, "See, I have told you beforehand." Go ahead and put up the slide, the sermon slide. It says, "See, I've told you beforehand." The idea is, I've warned you, now pay attention and stay alert. And as I was thinking about staying alert, I remembered about a week and a half ago, I was coming home from Folsom with Joshua, and we stopped at the gas station, got some gas, and we went inside to get a drink, and as I was looking at the drinks, it was one of those, first world problems. There's like 100 options, and just none of them sounded good to me. And so I'm looking around, and there was a bottle that caught my eye that looked different than all the other bottles. So it was a great marketing technique, and I fell prey to the marketing technique. And I grabbed that bottle, and it said Tangerine Dreams on it, and I thought, that sounds good. I don't know why. What's Tangerine Dreams, right? But anyhow, I grabbed that, bought it. We left, drove down the road. About halfway or two-thirds of the way home, I started feeling super drowsy. Not like normal drowsy when you're driving, when you're like, okay, I gotta get myself woken up here a little bit. I mean, super drowsy. I started thinking, did I like not sleep last night? Did I go to bed late? I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then it dawned on me that the drink I had was called Tangerine Dreams. And I started, really intelligent. I started working this through in my mind. And so while I'm falling asleep at the wheel, driving, I look at this bottle, and I turn over, and I look at the front of the bottle first, and in great big letters, the biggest letters on the whole bottle, it says, "Sleep." That's what it was called. The drink was called Sleep, and somehow I missed that when I picked it out, all right? So then I'm like, weird, they're selling something that puts you to sleep in a gas station? Couldn't be, all right? So I flip it over the back, and it says, "Do not drink this drink when driving or operating heavy machinery because it will cause you to be drowsy." And I look at the ingredients, it has melatonin in it. And so I had a choice to make here, as I'm like I can either just pull over and sleep for the rest of the night on the side of the road with Joshua. I can ask Joshua, who's 10, to drive home. It was a stick shift car. Or I can just make myself stay awake and get home, which I did. I got home. I went inside. I told Mary, "I'm feeling really tired." And I sat down on the couch. And I was out. And she woke me up. She said, "It's dinner time." And this was the night before she left on her trip. So she's like packing and feeding the kids. And I'm crashed out on the couch. So I eat dinner. And after dinner, I get up. And I'm just, I'm feeling tired. So I go and I sit down somewhere else again. I'm out cold again. So I take three, 45-hour naps before finally at, 9:30, I went to bed for the rest of the night. And I felt so refreshed in the morning. I felt so good. So if you have trouble sleeping, there's this stuff called Sleep. It's in the gas station in El Dorado Hills, and it will work wonders. Just don't drink while driving in more than one way. anyways, the importance of staying alert. And so I was thinking about the importance of staying alert. Also reminded me of a time when I think I was in high school, maybe it might have been right after high school. I was driving home from Modesto with my brothers, all three brothers in the car with me. And my brother Ben was sitting in the front seat next to me, and David and Stephen were in the back. And they all fell asleep, and it was late at night, and I got bored. And it's not good when I get bored. When I get bored, bad things happen to other people. So I got bored and I thought, oh, I bet you I could scare these guys really good. You know, they were no longer staying alert. It's bad news. You got to stay alert, otherwise bad things happen. And so I waited until there's a big line of headlights coming our way. And just as the headlights are coming our way, I simultaneously honk the horn, scream, ah, and I wiggle the wheel like this. And the car's like, woo, 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 woo. And Ben, his legs go straight out. He grabs the dashboard like this. His eyes get big as saucers. And in the back seat, all I hear, this still cracks me up to this day, I don't hear anything except David going, Stephen, it's okay. Stephen, it's okay. Stephen, 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 it's okay. Stephen, it's okay. I can just imagine what he was doing back there. David's just like, come on, man. Come on. Pull yourself together. Anyhow, and then you may have heard about this, but, you know, the whole Pokemon Go thing is all crazy thing going on. Nintendo's stock went up 33% on the release of Pokemon Go, and people are dying. You hear about this. People playing the game are dying. People are walking off cliffs. There was a couple guys, I don't even think they were teenagers. They're playing Pokemon Go, and they're walking along, and then they fall off a cliff down in San Diego because they're playing the game while they're walking around. You got to stay alert. Pokemon Go is dangerous to your health. People have walked into trees, reported various injuries playing this game. I'm actually very interested in the game. I might actually play it, but I don't know. Part of me thinks that will be too hard on my pride if I have to admit that I played it. But I'm very intrigued. It's a very interesting concept, very unique. I know that it was built on another thing that's been around for a while, but this is a very unique concept. It's a cool thing. It's neither here nor there. It has nothing to do with the passage. So as we look at this passage, I just want to remind you again what my perspective is on the purpose of end times, the end times scriptures that we have in the Bible. I don't think that the purpose of end times scriptures is for us to come up with a very specific and detailed sequence of events that are going to occur right before the return of Jesus Christ. I think the purpose of end time scriptures is to inspire in believers a sense of anticipation for the return of Jesus, that we would live with anticipation for those who are suffering with hope and for those who are comfortable and safe with urgency, that we wouldn't let ourselves become so discouraged if we're suffering for our faith that we want to give up, and if we're comfortable and safe that we wouldn't become lackadaisical and careless and just not worry too much about the seriousness of what we're dealing with here with our faith, that we would live with a sense of anticipation. Next slide, please. What's happening? Next slide. There we go. Primary purpose of end times. Scripture is to inspire God's people to live with anticipation, hope and suffering, and urgency in comfort. This passage we're going to look at this morning is the most difficult one of the whole section, at least for me. So all of 24 and 25, this section was the most difficult. And the reason, one of the main reasons it's most difficult is because I still haven't found an end times system, an eschatology that satisfies me. So I've studied, I would say, all the different ones, and I haven't found one that satisfies me. All of them, for me, have holes and faults that I can't just say, that must be it. Because if you have one of these eschatologies, what they do is they smooth over the complicated, confusing passages, and they figure out how to either ignore it or make sense of it, and I just can't. So just to kind of give you a kind of a big picture of the different eschatologies that have been held throughout the centuries, maybe you can put yourself in one of those, or just to kind of know how it's gone historically. But historic premillennialism was what was most popular in the early church. So from the time of the apostles through the 300, 400 AD, they believed in historic premillennialism, which meant they believed believers were going to endure all the awful things that are talked about in Scripture, and then that Jesus was going to set up a millennial kingdom, literal millennial kingdom, from Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 7. But then when Constantine came along and Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, perspectives changed a little bit, and amillennialism became very popular. They believed this must be the millennium. Jesus, look it, the Christian religion is becoming the official religion of the entire known world. Jesus must be reigning. This must be the millennium. But things didn't get better. Things got worse. And so in the 1800s, somewhere in the 1800s, something called dispensationalism became really popular. And dispensationalism really got popular in the early 1900s, especially as Israel became a nation and people started looking at that and thinking, well, maybe there is something to this. And dispensationalism is the one that still remains pretty popular today, especially among people that don't study the subject a lot, and dispensationalism is the belief that the Christians won't endure the tribulation, that, you know, at any moment right now, while everything is fine for many of us, that Jesus is going to appear, the church is going to be raptured, and we're going to get to escape all the horrible tribulations. And if you are familiar at all with the Left Behind books, I read a bunch of the Left Behind books, like six or seven of them. I thought that was great stuff. The dispensational approach to eschatology is the most captivating. It's the most exciting one. It makes the best stories. It makes the best movies. You know, Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth. And they even made Left Behind movies. You might have seen those. It really is a fun belief system, but it's not satisfying to me. And what's interesting to me is that now we're seeing a resurgence in the original approach to eschatology. That there's more, from my research, there's more respectable theologians that are going back to historical premillennialism, what our church fathers held in the first 300 years of Christianity. John Piper, George Eldon Ladd, there's a whole list of them that are holding to that historic premillennialism. Now, if all those words, you're like, I have no idea what he just said. Don't even worry about it. Just make sure your hope is in Jesus and in nothing else. That these passages that we study just make you think, I can't wait till Jesus comes back. I'm going to be ready. Don't worry about not understanding what any of those words mean. So this is most difficult because none of those systems really, really satisfy me. If you're wondering where I lean, because one of the frustrations that I have in studying this is you read what these different scholars are saying about these passages, and they don't tell you exactly where they're coming from. And so I get frustrated, like, okay, so fine, you say that this phrase means this, but what is it that you believe about the whole thing that affects the way you think about this? And so I have to go do a bunch of extra research to find out where certain people stand. So in case you're wondering, I also lean towards historic premillennialism right now. That could change at any moment. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. The context of this passage we need to keep in mind, and so you remember at the end of 23, Jesus just lights up the religious leaders. He lets them have it. He blasts them. He says, the blood of every innocent prophet that was killed by your forefathers is on your head, and I'm going to destroy Jerusalem. And then, you know, it's the mic drop, and he walks away. And he leaves the Temple Mount and he and his disciples, and they get outside of Jerusalem, and his disciples turn around, and they point back to the temple, and they say, look at that. Look at how incredible that thing is. One of the wonders of the ancient world, probably the most magnificent building that would still, if it was still standing today, one of the magnificent buildings from antiquity, covered in gold, layered in gold, the finest white marble it was created with. And his disciples say, look at that. Is that, you're really going to destroy that? And Jesus says, yes, there will not be one stone left on another when I'm done. And so they ask, when is this going to happen? Tell us. What are the signs of your return, the signs of the end of the age? And so he goes through the first few verses that we talked about a couple weeks ago, and then he gets to this section, starting in verse 15. Before we read verse 15, I want to point out a few things to you, though. The thing that makes this section so difficult starts in verse 29 with the word immediately. That word was very difficult for me to get over this week, to figure out. That word immediately creates a very unique challenge. In addition to that word, you have in verse 34 the phrase this generation. That creates a very unique challenge in how we interpret and understand what Jesus says here. So at the end, or during this message, if you don't already know what your eschatology is, you will not be satisfied by the end of this message. I'll warn you ahead of time. I don't have an answer. So I'm going to give you some options, but then I want to redirect our attention to what really matters from all of this. So you'll have some options to choose from, but I don't think those are the things that are most important. What we need to remember is what Jesus says in verse 36. He says, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. I think that's one of the verses that we need to read all of this through that lens. So let's go ahead and read Matthew chapter 24, starting in verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down and take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back and take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. And if they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heavens, and the power of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in the heavens the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So Jesus gets extremely explicit here. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, then you're going to know that things are going to get real. Then you're going to know it's going to get hot, and you got to go. You got to go. You got to run. You got to head for the hills. If you're on the roof, and he's describing an ancient Jewish house which has a flat roof, and the top of the roof was like what we have as a patio. It's where they have barbecues. It's where they drink tea. It's where they dry fruit, stuff like that. And then there's stairs that go down the outside of the house. So Jesus is saying, if you're up there on the roof having a barbecue, and you hear about or you see the abomination of desolation set up in the holy place, run. Go downstairs. Don't even go inside. Just take off, because it is going to be really bad. Do not waste a second. And if you're out in the field working, don't go home for your coat. Just run. And boy, pray that you're not pregnant or nursing in that time, because you don't want to try running if you're pregnant or nursing. And because pregnant women don't tend to be the most fleet of foot, right? Not the most nimble. Yeah. So, you know, hope that that's not true of you, and pray that it's not winter time, and pray that it's not the Sabbath, because on the Sabbath, you can't go more than a Sabbath journey, as far as a synagogue. And many of the stores outside of the towns are shut down. You can't buy supplies. And pray that it's not winter, because in winter, the roads are impassable in some places. You won't be able to escape. This is going to be horrible, he says. There's going to be a tribulation, Jesus says, that is unlike anything that ever has been or ever will be. And when we hear that word tribulation, we get, I think, a lot of times hung up on our different preconceived ideas of what tribulation is. The word tribulation in this passage is just a common word in the Greek language. It means pressure, distress, or trouble. Jesus is saying there's going to be a time of distress or trouble or pressure unlike there ever has been and ever unlike there ever will be. Therefore, pay attention. Watch for that abomination of desolation so that you can run. And then he says it's going to be so bad that if God doesn't supernaturally intervene and cut things short, everybody will die. But because of the elect, because of God's people, he will intervene and cut things short. He says, and then after that, people are going to be so desperate. They're going to be so hurting. They're going to be so looking for hope that they will be easily deceived by false teachers. He says, don't let yourselves be deceived by false prophets or false messiahs. He says in verse 25, see, I have told you beforehand. I've warned you. Don't let that happen to you. Don't follow them. Don't go to them if somebody tells you about them. Because he says, when I come back, it's going to be like lightning flashing across the sky from the east to the west. And I can't emphasize this enough. I don't think anybody in this room would actually fall for a false prophet or a false messiah. I shouldn't say that. I don't think anybody in this room would fall for a false messiah. I do think there's false prophets out there that are very convincing that people can easily fall for. But Jesus is saying this, listen, don't fall for anybody that tells you that Jesus is back. He says, I'm going to return in such a way that nobody is going to be able to miss it. You're never going to have to wonder, did Jesus return and I missed it? Is he in a different country? Do I need to go find him somewhere? Everybody will know. Don't be deceived. And then he says, because where the carcasses are, there the vultures will gather. He says, you're going to see a whole bunch of people pursuing a whole bunch of dead, rotting religions that are nothing but death to them. You're going to see it gathering and accumulating all around. Avoid it. Don't let yourself become stuck in that dead, in any dead, rotting religion. And then he says, immediately after those things, immediately after that time of distress and trouble, the moon and the sun will go dark, the stars will crash to the ground, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations will mourn and fall to their faces and exclaim and mourn because they didn't respond to Jesus when he was here, because they rejected him. And then he says, everybody will see the Son of Man appear on the clouds, and he will send his angels, and they will gather the elect from the four ends of heavens, and they will gather them together. He says, learn the lesson from the fig tree. When you see the leaves sprout, you know summer is near. Stay alert. Pay attention. When you see the leaves sprout, you know that summer is near. When you see these things, you know that I will be at the gate, ready to come bursting through the gate. All these things will happen before this generation passes away. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will never pass away. So what I want to do is I want to look at this from a couple different angles. I want to look at it first from the vantage point of the disciples as they heard this, because their vantage point is very different than ours. So look at it from where they were standing. What did they hear, and how did they interpret it, and how did they apply it to their situation, and how did they move forward with that? It's very important for us, I think, to think about that. Where were they coming from? And then look at it from our vantage point. What do we see now, 2,000 years later? How do we interpret what Jesus said? I'll deal with a couple difficult passages, and then I really want to focus on what's most important at the very end, what really matters most. So first of all, from their vantage point, number one, Jesus is saying these things to them, right? You read this, who does it sound like Jesus is talking about? Is he talking about some generation way off in the future? Does Jesus say, make sure you tell your children and your grandchildren or great-grandchildren, because sometime in the distant future I will be returning? No, he says it like he's talking to them. Everything in here indicates that he's talking to them, especially phrases like verse 25. See, I have told you beforehand. In addition to that, the temple's still standing. So they're looking forward to this destruction of the temple. And when they see the destruction of the temple, to them, that's a sign that the end is near. To them, that's a sign that he's going to return. You see specific reference to the people in Judea. He doesn't say here anybody who's in a major metropolis. When you hear about the abomination of desolation spoken of in Daniel, head for the hills. He says, if you're in Judea, it's a very specific location, the area of Jerusalem. Judea is like the county, like Amador, and Jerusalem would be like Ione or Jackson. He speaks of very specific circumstances to those people at that time. Flat-roofed houses, agrarian society, farmers, talking about the Sabbath day and the roads in winter. It's very specific to that situation. They're thinking, this is us, this is now, this is imminent. And then finally he says that this will happen in this generation. One really cool thing from this is in verses 29 to 31, where Jesus says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and he just describes this apocalyptic situation. In those two verses, or three verses, 29 to 31, there's 16 references to Old Testament prophecy. Jesus weaves together in those few sentences 16 different apocalyptic prophecies from the Old Testament because he knew his Bible that well. Furthermore, I think that when you look at verse 16, where Jesus is talking about the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, Matthew adds this little thing that says, let the reader understand. Maybe Matthew is writing the Gospel of Matthew right when things are starting to get heated up in Jerusalem. Maybe right when things are starting to unfold, and he's writing this and he's remembering what Jesus said, and he adds this little footnote for his for the readers to think, let the reader understand, this is happening right now. Their mentality was that it was happening in their time. That's how they viewed this whole situation. What's our vantage point? We look at it now, looking back on history. Number two, in that the temple has been destroyed. It was destroyed in AD 70. And what unfolded during that time fits perfectly with what Jesus said here. Jesus said, not one stone will be left on another. And that's, the temple was completely destroyed. Every stone was removed from the temple other than the floor, the foundation stones of the temple. In addition, that time, the siege of Jerusalem was one of the most horrifying, miserable, bloody times that any city has ever experienced. So Jesus says that's going to be a time of pressure and distress and trouble like has never been and will never be again. And during that time, the zealots were constantly causing trouble. The zealots were probably the Jewish equivalent of what we would say now would be like the radical Islamic terrorists. Violent people who believed that the only solution was violence and who would stop at nothing to bring about their cause, even killing their own people. The zealots were known for killing other Jews who just wanted to be peaceful, who just wanted to say, hey, you know, we pay a little bit of extra taxes, but everything's okay. Let's not bother Rome. They would kill even those people, their fellow Jews. And they would stop at nothing. They were violent. They would use all tactics necessary to kill anybody that stood in their way. So the zealots were stirring up trouble during this time, and they kept attacking Roman outposts, and they actually had a lot of victories, slaughtering thousands and thousands of Roman soldiers with their surprise attacks and really their terrorist tactics. And at one point in the mid to late 60s, there was one of these zealot leaders named Menahem who came along, Menahem, son of Judas, who came along, and he was known for being extra violent, and he was killing anybody that didn't join their cause, men, women, children. And he worked his way into Jerusalem and became kind of the de facto leader of Jerusalem's zealot movement. And he went into the temple because the high priest was not agreeing with his approach, and he slaughtered the high priest, and he established himself as the high priest in the temple, even claiming to be the Messiah. What does that sound like? The abomination of desolation. And shortly after that, the Romans come along because they're sick and tired of this, and they surround Jerusalem with four legions of soldiers in about April of 70 AD, approaching or even more than 30,000 soldiers. They surround Jerusalem, and as a part of the siege of Jerusalem, the zealots who are inside are not only killing anybody who won't participate with them, but they destroy all the food resources that are saved up in Jerusalem so that none of their enemies can get to them, which brings on massive starvation. There's starvation, there's drought inside Jerusalem, and it's so bad that Josephus records that women were known for eating their own children to stay alive. And then finally, after about 4 months, from April to August, the Romans are successful. They finally get into Jerusalem. They kill almost everybody. Josephus records that since it was Passover time and there was a whole bunch more people in Jerusalem than there normally were, that it was over 1 million people were slaughtered in Jerusalem by the Roman legions. And over 100,000 were taken as slaves. What does that sound like? That sounds like the worst distress and trouble that ever has been or ever will be. And if it wasn't for God supernaturally intervening and cutting those days short, nobody would have survived. Isn't that what it sounds like? From our perspective, that's exactly what it sounds like. And most people agree that on some level or to some degree, this was the fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy of the tribulation that he describes here. Following that, many have been deceived by imposters. You go through a time of difficulty like that, and you look to leaders to give you hope. And so many fell prey to people who deceived them. And one of the most famous ones was a guy named Simon Bar Kokhba, who came after that. He himself claimed again to be the Messiah, and again led a revolt against the Romans, and people gave their lives to him. But from our vantage point, we're still waiting for Jesus' return, aren't we? Even though all of those events sound like things that fulfill the prophecies of Jesus, the thing that hasn't been fulfilled, as far as we can tell, is the sun and moon going dark, the stars crashing to heaven, the powers of the heavens being shaken, and the Son of Man appearing in the sky. That's what we seem to not have be seeing from our perspective here. So what are the possible explanations for verses 29 and 34? Verses 29 and 34. Number three, here's some possible explanations for you. You can just take them and do with them as you choose. The first one is that Jesus already returned and we missed it. This is one that people hold. It's called the preterist view, and their perspective is that Jesus' return was actually more of a supernatural return. It's one that kind of happened in the spiritual realm, and everything that Jesus says here is symbolic, and that when it says that he gathered his elect from the four ends of heaven or the four corners of heaven, that was the establishment of the church. And everything in the Bible that's apocalyptic, end times, all of it happened by 70 AD or shortly thereafter. I don't believe that. I think that's wrong, obviously, but that is one that people hold. The next one is that verses 15 to 28 don't refer to events of 70 AD at all. It looks like it from our perspective. Looking back on history, it seems to fit, but that's not what Jesus meant. That would solve the problem of the word immediately and even the word this generation. You could say, okay, well, it just hasn't happened yet. It's all in the future, right? So when it happens in the future, when what Jesus described in the future happens, then immediately will occur, and it's this generation that sees things unfolding that are going to see it actually come to an end. So that solves the problem if you look at it from that perspective. Problem then there is the temple still has to be rebuilt, right? Because the abomination of desolation in the holy place means that has to be in the where the temple is, at least where the temple is. Another option is verse 15 to 28 have multiple fulfillments. We do see this in the Old Testament prophecy, that Old Testament prophecy has an immediate fulfillment, then it has a future fulfillment. And so that's possible. Even Jesus uses that here in this example when he says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, Daniel said that in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel chapter 11, and Daniel chapter 12. And everybody agrees, virtually everybody agrees, that that was fulfilled initially when Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple to Zeus. That would be an abomination, right? That would be considered an abomination. So it was fulfilled once there, but Jesus says there's still another fulfillment. So it's possible there's multiple fulfillments, that we just need to keep watching for this, and when we see this happen, then that's the handwriting on the wall that the end might be near. So if the temple gets rebuilt, then we could be looking for that to happen again. And there's a lot of people that believe that the temple is going to be rebuilt. I mean, imagine in those, some of you lived through those years when Israel became a nation again and they reestablished themselves and they became very influential and self-sufficient. And there was a lot of talk about the temple being rebuilt, and if the temple was rebuilt and then the sacrifices were restarted, that this was it. This was the beginning of the end. But we haven't seen that happen. And from our perspective, it doesn't look like the temple is going to be rebuilt anytime soon. That would kick off World War III at the best case scenario. So multiple fulfillments is a possibility. And then finally, Jesus meant something different than this generation and immediately. This is also possible. Any of the last three, I think, are possible, that Jesus said the Son of Man or the Son doesn't even know when these things will happen. That Jesus, when he came to earth, he was fully God and fully man, but what he did is his deity submitted to his humanity. Hopefully that makes sense to you. His godness willingly became controlled by his manness. So what he knew as God, he gave up that knowledge to become man. Willingly. It wasn't forced upon him, therefore he was still fully God. But he chose that weakness, he chose that lowliness. And so that included what he knew about the future. So he knew, because he knew Old Testament prophecy, he knew that things were going to happen in a certain way, but he didn't know exactly how they were going to play themselves out. So one way of thinking about this is when you're driving down the road and you see mountains up ahead of you. Like let's say you're going to Disneyland and you see the grapevine, right? It's like the grapevine, right? And doesn't it seem like when you see the grapevine, it seems like, oh, we're going to be there in 20 minutes. But it's still like an hour and a half to get to the grapevine, right? And then when you look at the grapevine, you're like, oh, that's just a little hill. We'll just like whoop over it, you know, no big deal, 20 minutes. But then your car overheats and it takes an hour to drive through the grapevine, right? And so from this perspective, looking way down, it looks like no big deal. But then when you actually get into it, it just takes way longer than you expected. You do this when you look at any mountains. You see these layers of mountains off in the distance, and they don't look like they're going to be that imposing. But then as you get into them, it just takes forever to get through them. And when you look at them from up above, you're like, oh my gosh, those mountains took, no wonder it took forever. There was a huge distance between them. It's possible that Jesus, as he's looking by prophecy, he doesn't know the exact timing and way it's all going to play out. He just knows it's going to happen like this. And so immediately meant more something like subsequently or after or directly, that it didn't encapsulate the very next moment, but that it left room for thousands of years. I don't know. You guys have the Holy Spirit. You have God's Word. You figure it out. This is what I think is most important. Number four. It was a different time, but it's the same response. That the disciples had their perspective, their vantage point on what Jesus said. We have our vantage point on what Jesus says, but the response to what Jesus says is the same. The first part is that we would rest in God's sovereignty. They rested in God's sovereignty. Imagine what Matthew went through. He wrote this very likely just a few years before that siege of Jerusalem. He went through that whole process. He might have been thinking, Jesus is coming back at any moment. I know it because this fits the prophecy. And Jesus didn't come back, and he didn't come back, and years went by. What did Matthew do? Did he give up and say, God doesn't know what he's doing? I don't believe Jesus. No, he kept fighting for the gospel. He kept spending himself for the gospel. He brought the gospel all the way to Ethiopia and was killed because of his allegiance to Jesus Christ. He maintained his faith in Jesus. He rested in the sovereignty of God, even though it must have been difficult for him at times. I love this passage from Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40, one of my favorites. I have it here in the NLT because I like the way the NLT says it. You can go ahead and follow along or just listen. It's a long section. Who else held the oceans in his hand? Who has measured off the heavens with his finger? Who else knows the weight of the earth or has weighed the mountains and hills on a scale? Who's able to advise the Spirit of the Lord? Who knows enough to give him advice or teach him? Has the Lord ever needed anyone's advice? Does he need instruction about what is good? Did someone teach him what is right or show him the path of justice? No. For all the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. They are nothing more than dust on the scales. Pause there and think about that. All the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. They are nothing more than dust on the scales. It doesn't matter if it's ancient Babylon or Egypt or the Roman Empire or the English Empire or America. All of them are nothing to God. They're but a drop in the bucket. They're dust on the scales. He picks up the whole earth as if it were a grain of sand. And that's exaggeration. Not exaggeration that it's actually more like a golf ball. Exaggeration like it's not even a grain of sand that God holds the earth. God sits above the circle of the earth. The people below seem like grasshoppers to him. He spreads out the heavens like a curtain and makes his tent from them. He judges the great people of the world and he brings them all to nothing. They hardly get started, barely taking root, when he blows on them and they wither. The wind carries them off like chaff. To whom will you compare me? Who is my equal? Asks the Holy One. Look up into heavens. Who created all the stars? He brings them out like an army, one after another, calling each by its name. Because of his great power and incomparable strength, not a single one is missing. The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. He never grows weak or weary. No one can measure the depths of his understanding. He gives power to the weak and strength to the powerless. Even youths will become weak and tired, and young men will fall in exhaustion. But those who trust in the Lord will find new strength. They will soar high on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. Same response, different time. Trusting in the sovereignty of God, resting in the sovereignty of God. Second one is be prepared for suffering. Not something that we are real used to experiencing here in the United States. We have tremendous freedom and rules that protect us, though sometimes we still do experience some suffering, but we still need to be prepared to experience that suffering. His disciples, when they first heard it, it was clear they need to be ready to experience suffering. 2,000 years later, it's the same warning to us. Look at Romans chapter 8, starting in verse 16. We're going to go to 25, but I'm going to skip a section there. So Romans 8, 16 says this, "The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with Him in order that we may also be glorified with Him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." You skip down to verse 23, "And not only is creation, but we ourselves groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons and the redemption of our bodies." Do you groan eagerly? Do you groan inwardly as you wait eagerly for that adoption of your body as sons and daughters? Verse 24, "For in this hope we were saved." Hope. We're to live with hope, anticipation and hope. "For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience." Response is that we would be prepared for suffering, that we would groan inwardly for the redemption of our bodies, that we would have hope and that we would wait with patience. Don't be distressed by world events. All kinds of crazy things going on around us, isn't it? This world is breaking down. It seems like the wheels are coming off. I don't know that it's any worse. The 24-hour news cycle sure makes us aware of every bad thing that's going on, right? Things have been going badly for a very long time. But things look like they're going really badly around us right now. Everything from what's going on in our country to what's going on the other side of the world, this place is a disaster, but we don't need to be distressed as followers of Jesus. Jesus told us it was coming. He told us there's a plan. Everything is set in place. God knows what's coming. He knows what's going to happen. Nothing is catching him off guard. He's not in heaven wringing his hands going, "Why is that happening? I didn't intend that." He knows exactly how everything is going to play out. We can be saddened by what happens to people. We can be broken about that. We can be experience sorrow, and we can mourn it, and we can seek to be a part of the solution, but we don't need to be distressed. Jesus told us it was going to happen. One of the things that really distresses me is how, as a church, we can be so quick to look outside these four walls and point out everything that's wrong out there. Everything that people are thinking wrongly out there and doing wrongly out there and all the problems they're causing out there. And what I really think we need to make sure we focus on is that we would look inside these four walls and we would evaluate how we're doing. We would let Scripture penetrate our hearts and our marriages and our relationships, that we would refine the body of Christ, because when we get this right in here, it has a profoundly positive effect out there. When we get this wrong in here, it has a profoundly negative effect out there. That we wouldn't be deceived or distracted. The whole point of deception is that it's tricky, right? You don't get deceived by something that's obvious. You get deceived by things that trick you, that catch you off guard, that you weren't ready for, so that we'd make sure that we were prepared not to be deceived or distracted. I love this passage in Hebrews chapter 3. It says this, Hebrews 3:13, "But exhort one another every day as long as it is called today." Exhort one another every day as long as it is called today. Encourage, challenge, spur, exhort, correct each other every day as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. We got to have each other's backs on this. We got to be working in each other's lives so that none of us gets deceived or distracted. And then that we would live with anticipation, like I've been talking about. That Jesus' followers heard Jesus say this, and it caused them to live with anticipation. Our different perspective, we should still read these passages, and it should still cause us to live with anticipation and urgency and hope for Jesus' imminent return. And then finally, that we would make sure our soul is ready. That if we think we're a Christian, that we would really take time to ask and evaluate if we actually are a Christian. You're not saved just because you say you're a Christian, and you're not saved just because you pray to prayer, and you're not saved because you go to church, and you're not saved because your parents are Christians. God has no grandchildren. It's absolutely essential that you not be deceived into thinking that you're a Christian for a false reason, but that you ask, what does Jesus call me to be saved? What is it that he's asking of me? And it comes down to a deep conviction. Whether you call yourself a Christian and you need to reevaluate that, or you've never made that conscious decision, it comes down to this. Like Michael Fugit talked about last week in this epidemic that he sees in the church in America, that something that I've said over and over and over again, that when you're talking with somebody about eternity and the subject of heaven comes up, and you express that you think you're going to heaven, and they say why, that I desperately, desperately hope that nobody that goes to Cornerstone for any amount of time would ever let the words come out of their mouth, "because I'm a pretty good person." That's the opposite of the gospel. It undermines everything that Jesus came for. But that we would understand that we are absolutely depraved sinners and hopeless. That there's not anything that we could do to earn favor with God or earn our salvation. That we are hopeless. We are lost and without God in this world. That it is only through the death of Jesus on the cross, who paid for our sins, and that free gift, that we can be made right with God. And when we understand that, when we understand how sinful we are and how incredible that gift is, it should create this incredible love and joy in us and this desire to follow Jesus and live our lives for Him. If you've never made that conscious decision and come to that deep conviction, don't wait any longer. I'd love to talk to you about it after the service, or email me or call me this week. It's the biggest decision that you'll ever make. Make sure that your soul is ready, because Jesus said, I'm coming back. I'm coming back. And there's no second chances.